Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens, families, educators, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that sometimes confront, intersect, and interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Sarah Allen Benton's book, Parents in Recovery, Navigating a Sober Family Lifestyle, is a guide for parents working to raise children while maintaining a sober lifestyle. Benton blends her personal journey with her expertise as a licensed mental health counselor and addiction specialist to address the unique challenges that recovery can bring into the family. The book addresses how sobriety affects parenting styles, emotional resilience, relations, and the digital pressures modern parents face. Benton provides insights into establishing a healthy, sober family lifestyle by focusing on values, connections, and support networks. Sarah Allen Benton joins us via Zoom platform from Connecticut. Sarah, welcome to 411 Teen.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Oh, I'm so glad to have you. I think the information you have to share is just invaluable. First of all, I mean, did I do justice to your book? Did I give it a kind of accurate overview?
Yes.
Okay.
You really did. Okay. I appreciate it.
All right. Just wanted to make sure. What inspired you to write Parents in Recovery? And what makes your book unique or different? Because, you know, there are a lot of books out there talking about parents and recovering from alcoholism.
Well, what sparked it was actually a combination of things. I would say it was like an aha moment. I walked into a bookstore and I saw a book by Cindy House called Mother Noise. And my daughter was around the same age, 11, as her son. And she was in recovery and hadn't shared with him that why she was sober, the reasons behind it. And it occurred to me after that was a memoir. I started to look up nonfiction books around the topic of parenting, sobriety, all of that. And I realized that there was hardly anything out there, especially for both mothers and fathers. And I kind of knew that was what I was meant to write at that time. Mm-hmm. Because, first of all, I had always known that there was something unique about the experience of being in recovery as a parent. And I know that I share that bond with many other parents, and I call them peers, P-I-R-S, mm-hmm. for the acronym. But I knew there was a little something different about the way in which we structured and lived our lives. And it's something we had all figured out over time by trial and error. But I was thinking, you know, what if there were a field guide or something that would short circuit the process a little, or how could I integrate all of this wisdom from all of these amazing parents into a book for people? So that's really where it rose from, that moment in the bookstore, but also from the realization that there was not much out there.
In your book, you talk about, you know, parenting approaches, and how does a parent's sobriety influence their parenting approach?
Well, it actually influences everything. And I mm-hmm. always say that then the subtitle is, you know, a sober lifestyle, which is very broad, right? It's not just sobriety, period, right? It's this idea that there's a way in which you live your life that's different when you get into a place of recovery from an addiction. There's mental health issues, other things that are people in recovery from. But just like addiction affects every aspect of someone's life, they don't necessarily realize it when they're using, but when they stop, they suddenly see how the people they were spending time with, the jobs they chose, the choices they made, the consequences that they had, there's so much that it informed everything. And so when you get sober and when you get into a place of balance or recovery or remission, mm-hmm. that you realize that that affects everything too. So it for sure impacts parenting in positive and negative ways, I would say. I think that there's pieces of it that can be, I did have a control group actually of parents who are not in recovery. And that was actually illuminating to sort of see some of the differences in thought patterns and behaviors. But yeah, I'd say it affects every aspect of it.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think it's important for children to know about their parents' addictions? I mean, and in addition to that, are children, do you feel like children are ever too young for an honest conversation about substance use disorder?
Well, I found from the interviews that I did with parents in recovery that everyone sort of had their own comfort zone around when they felt it was appropriate to talk about those subjects with their kids. For some, you know, their children have been going to self-help meetings since a very young age, and it was something that they were just kind of born into and were going to, and it was part of the dialogue from as long as they could remember. For others, they felt that they didn't want to share that information with their children until they had to. Speaking to it personally, I think that is a choice, that there isn't a wrong answer around the younger ages. I have to say, from a professional perspective, because I am an addiction therapist as well, I would recommend that by the time your children have or are exposed to substances in their lives, in their families, in their social circles, with the tweens, teens. Mm-hmm. But it's important to have the discussion around your genetic history around addiction in the family, just like it is for medical conditions that many people talk to their children about having predispositions for certain medical conditions. But the same can be said about addiction, because if a person is aware at an early enough age about their family history, mm-hmm. they can also make more informed choices. For example, if somebody starts drinking after the age of 15, they can decrease their chance of developing alcohol use disorder by 40% and then 7% each year that they push it off. So that's amazing information to have, right? That you could actually decrease your chances of developing a problem that your parents had if you, you know, push out the age of onset. So I think it's important mm-hmm. and invaluable, and our responsibility to set our children up for success.
Well, do you have any suggestions that you would offer that would aid in opening up communication about sobriety with children? Are there any particular age-appropriate ways to discuss it that you would share with the listening audience?
Sure. So I'd say I can personally, how I realized that my daughter was ready for a conversation, it actually came up because of electronics. She had spent too much time on an iPad one weekend, and she ended up writing, and I actually included it in my book. I do have journal entries at the end of each chapter. But she talked about how she felt that when she stopped, she spent too much time on it, and that she felt almost like she used the word addicted, but that she couldn't stop using it. And then when she put it down, she felt very irritable, and she was able to see that and use the word addicted, which was probably a little bit of a strong word, mm-hmm. but the concept was there for me, that I could see that she understood the concept of powerlessness or the concept of feeling like, you know, you lost a little bit of self-control. And that was around 11 or 12 when I was writing this book. So I did decide, my husband and I, to have the conversation with her because I did feel conceptually she could understand it. I think if you're talking to your children at younger ages, you may be having a conversation about it, but they may not really get what you're saying. I think that food is also a good comparison for people. Oftentimes, substances are confusing, even to talk to family members who don't have addiction issues. And when I've talked to people who don't have a frame of reference, I've said, you know, like when your favorite ice cream or your favorite cookie, and you have one of them, but then your shutoff isn't there, and you just can't stop having the cookies until they're all gone. And then you're thinking about the cookies and you want the cookies the next day and the next day. So sometimes using other things that can have addictive properties, I think phones, food, can really help them to understand at least the concept of a loss of self-control.
What role do partners and extended family play in supporting a sober household? How can they, I guess, help and hinder the recovery?
Well, addiction is a family disease. We've heard that time and time again, and recovery is a family solution. And it involves not just the identified patient, as we would say, or the person that has the addictive issue in the household, but it also involves recovery from everybody in the family. So you can often see patterns in family systems where the person that had the addictive behavior often has a partner who may have been turning a blind eye or not confronting or avoiding. And again, everybody has their way of dealing. It's not right or wrong. It's just what people do. However, in recovery, it's not just about the person with the addictive issue getting help and support. It's also about loved ones getting help and support for their experiences, the trauma they went through, and how their trust may not be there, or they're paranoid because every time the person comes home, you know, after going out to dinner, they're afraid that their partner has been using or drinking. So this is a recovery process that involves everybody in the family, and including the children, adult children, adolescents. You know, again, different people have different awareness, right? I know one of the people I interviewed, or several, got sober after their children were old enough to know, right, that they had an addictive issue. And so their recovery was, they were very open about it because they were very aware that their parent had an addictive issue.
Can I ask you, excuse me, just to hold your thoughts for a minute. You're tuned in to 411 Teen, and this hour I am talking with Sarah Allen Benton, author of Parents in Recovery. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you and continue our stimulating educational conversation. Let me reintroduce my program guest, Sarah Allen Benton, author of Parents in Recovery. She's a licensed advanced alcohol and drug counselor, addiction counselor, and mental health counselor. She has been in recovery from alcoholism for over 20 years. Sarah, I had to interrupt you. Would you like to continue your thoughts?
Sure. So, yeah, I actually forgot where I left off.
Well, you were just talking about the extended family and how important they were. And
right. So I think that what happens is a lot of attention goes to the person that has the actual addiction, right? Whether they're using, they're not using, they're going to use, they may use. I feel bad for a lot of the family members because I feel like they get left in the dark and they don't get their own healing. So that's really something that I focus on as a therapist, but also as a person in long-term recovery myself, parent in recovery. I know that it's not just, oh, you know, even when somebody thinks, oh, just send your loved one away to treatment for 30 days and then they come back and everything's all fixed. It's not like that, right? So everybody also has their own issue around it or part in it. And so that needs to be explored and examined. The involvement of the children is really up to, I would say, if you want, you know, if you have a child that's under, like a minor, it's important to have a therapist that's experienced working with adolescents because it's a different type of therapy model where they're actually including the family in the adolescent's therapy intermittently, not every session, but it's just a different model than 18 and over. So it's really important to have specialists involved as well.
Well, in this digital age filled with what, social media and virtual peer groups, do you have some strategies that parents can use to protect both themselves and their children from triggers or harmful influences?
Yeah, what was interesting to me, and I really chose to focus on that topic in my book because it's so prevalent in our society, and also the work of Dr. Anne Lemke, who wrote the book Dopamine Nation, brought light to this topic about how we live in a society that is dopamine priming, meaning we have a lot of things that are stimulating, and it's not just substances. It's not just alcohol. Mm-hmm. It's not just pot, right? There's electronics and social media and likes and posts and, you know, all of this, all of these ways to get affirmation and video games. And so what really came to mind for me is like, what is the connection between the two? And should parents in recovery be more mindful of their children's digital use and of their relationship to electronics, given the addiction history in their family? And, you know, it really was saying, you know, the research is saying that some electronic platforms, not every single one, but some, especially social media, and some of the also the videos, the TikToks, and the kind of the scrolling, the quick hit type electronics can hit the dopamine quickly. And then it's like, I need more. And it's got this, what she calls a priming effect. And the priming effect can also lead to other things like, I want more of that feeling, or I want more. And that, you know, opens the door to other addictive behavior. So there are connections to all of these things that hit our dopamine, whether it's gambling, spending, shopping. I mean, again, these things can be all done from the phone as well, right? We have a lot of access, including delivery of alcohol to our homes through apps, right?
That's so true.
It's amazing. It's, but it if is. You think about the phone, it's one-stop shopping for a million vices.
Yeah, you're right. You're on top of that. That's for sure.
So it really was something that I wanted to include and to integrate, because, again, it's not, the book isn't about, you know, electronic addiction, but it's about the thing that's so common as a parent that you deal with, and how, as parents in recovery, you know, should we look at this, and what is the research saying about the connection between electronics and teen substance use? So that was really where my focus was.
Well, will you offer some practical ways that parents can create a positive family culture around sobriety without making the children feel isolated or stigmatized?
That's such a good way to put it. And I hadn't thought of it that way, because we feel, right, as parents in recovery, sometimes we feel like the, you know, a little bit different than other parents. And we don't want our children to be feeling that from us. We also don't want them living in a bubble, because that's not reality. I don't at least want my daughter living in a bubble. But I don't think that the culture begins just with substance talk, right? I believe it's about the way that you communicate with your children around their emotions, opening their eyes to the fact that there are coping skills and strategies that they can use when they're feeling upset, sad, angry. Because what happened was, and I think, you know, other generations were really not taught much, especially in school. Therapy was stigmatized. There was a lot of shame associated with reaching out for help. And I think there still can be. A lot of parents don't want their kids to get therapy because they think that means they did something wrong as a parent. Right. But if we're getting ahead of the curve and we're trying to prevent self-medication for our children, that involves having a culture of we're talking about our emotions, we're vulnerable, we find healthy solutions, and we get our children the support they need before they start turning to other addictive behaviors to self-medicate. So it's not just about the substances, because it can also be turning to the phones and turning to all those other things too. You know, like the culture, my goal, and again, I don't know that I'm doing this perfectly at all, but my goal is that by the time substances are in the picture with my daughter, right, in the social circle, or she's in high school or whatever, that we've already laid the groundwork that she knows she can have an honest discussion and isn't just going to be punished for bringing up the topic or saying she was around something or that she thought about it or that she even did it. Like, that's not going to actually allow me to support her. That's just going to have her go underground.
Well, share some examples of family activities or traditions, even. We're coming up on these holidays, that reinforce sobriety in a supportive and inclusive way?
Well, some of it is funny because I don't think about it only because my daughter only knows my husband and I be in recovery. So it's interesting. We didn't really have to make changes in that way. A lot of the parents I interviewed have had to make changes because they got sober after becoming parents. So that's, you know, two different experiences. But I think some of it, as far as just the family traditions, is doing healthy things together, right? Like going hiking, exercising together, encouraging healthy mm-hmm. behaviors together. It's funny because I see a lot of people have to, unfortunately, get in trouble with the law or have to go to treatment before they start to learn how to live healthy and balanced lifestyles. And for some reason, we don't do as much ahead of time. Mm-hmm. So that's part of the family piece, is sort of doing this in a preventative way. Like, this is how we live our lives, and we try to eat healthy and balanced, and we try to do these different things, and we fail, right?
Yeah.
We're not perfect.
Not perfect.
This is not the household of perfection at all. And that, honestly, I lack patience, right? So for me, it's about owning that when I snap or when I lose my patience, and role modeling that I can admit I'm wrong, right? So that's part of it too, is this idea that parents are perfect and being put on a pedestal and trying to be the perfect parent. It actually can harm children because they don't feel like they can make mistakes.
Mm-hmm. Well, share a few strategies, I would say, for setting boundaries and finding balance, as we're looking at examples, and finding balance even with the social media. Do you have suggestions in that area?
Right. So again, and I think every parent is going to do things the way that they want to. I offered a buffet in my book, and you take from that buffet what you want and mm-hmm. leave the rest. So there are some suggestions. First of all, the phones now have parental control features that they didn't in the past. We actually had started off with Pinwheel, different phones that offered no social media. And she gradually moved through some of those phones, or they got discontinued. And then we had different limits. And then depending on her age, mm-hmm. we were able to trust her. Also, some of it is about trust. I think that it's easy to be a helicopter parent these days because you can track your kid. You can see how fast they're going. You can see what they're doing. You can see when they come to the door. You can see every single thing, right? So does that really teach people to use their best judgment? Not always.
No.
So it is important to, like, let go a little bit as well. And so that's where the dialogue comes in, and that's where the trust comes in, and having, you know, trusting the character of your child, but also being smart about it. The other pieces of it are what I've done with my daughter's actually, I tried to educate her around how do you feel when you've been on the phone too much? And then afterwards, what do you feel like? Or I'm observing, it looks like you've been on it too much. Let's go do something, right? So you have to also offer alternatives. Like, you mm-hmm. can't just, you can just say, like, don't go on your phone, and then just, there's nothing.
Right.
No other, like, nothing as a family, right? So some of it's spending quality time together, doing quality things together, or offering alternatives, or saying, you know, why don't you think of something else to do, because this is too much time. So there has to be the substitutes and the ideas and the discussion and the help, allowing them to also go too far and then have a discussion around it. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's what happened with my daughter, right? When she was around 11, I don't remember if it was during the pandemic. I can't remember what it was, but I just remember that she almost had like a tantrum when she got off of it. And that's not really her personality. And it was like this weird electronic withdrawal. And I think a lot of parents have seen that, and it's scary. It's very mm-hmm. scary, but it's important to point that out and to talk to them about it. Right. So does your mood feel better when you scroll and look at what everybody else is doing? I mean, adults face this with Facebook is probably more popular for my generation, or Instagram, TikTok maybe, but you know, looking at what everybody else is doing, does that make you feel better about yourself? It's just reminds me of the beauty magazines back in the day. You know, would you look at those and then feel great about yourself? Or would you look at those and think, oh my gosh, I never even thought about this. Mm-hmm. I don't like this about myself or that. So for me, it's about the dialogue and about the observations that you're helping and supporting them to make and talk to you about it, right? Not about doing it perfectly, but about learning from it.
How would you say digital exposure impacts recovery, especially regarding to mental health and stress? How does this digital exposure, from where you sit, impact, you know, recovery?
Well, this one I can also speak to personally and professionally. I think there's been blessings and then there's been curses from this. In a post-pandemic world, right, there's been some, I'm going to start out with the silver linings because I think there's been some really positive things. Electronics and technology get a bad rap, but we've also increased our access to care. There's a lot more therapy that's available now in rural areas or in areas where there's specialists that you can't drive to, you can now access virtually. There's also self-help meetings that used to be only in person in certain areas that other people couldn't access. Now there's all these self-help meetings all over the country and all over the world that you are at your fingertips. So I want to give a shout out to that because that's been a huge win. On the flip side, there is, it can be easy to isolate, right? It can be easy to feel like you're actually socializing when you're not. it can be easy to numb out and to avoid getting outside and taking care of yourself. And, because some people, have what we would call an addictive personality or maybe more of a sensitivity to that dopamine, then it is easier to get sucked into things and to possibly waste your day away. Like when people are getting treatment for mental health and for substance use disorders, a lot of what we're teaching also is around behavioral scheduling, like creating, you know, a balance to your day, creating an order of events, allowing you to be efficient, getting your to-do list done. If you're just sucked into electronics, that can get in the way. The other problem is this FOMO, fear of missing out issue, where, you know, people are just posting the best of. Like I always say, everybody's their own PR person. They're just putting out marketing about themselves. Look how great my life is. Look, you know, this was so fun. Oh my gosh, look at us. We're so cute. And it's ironic because usually the people that are having the hardest time put out the most positive PR about themselves. And people see this, especially those going through a real hard time, and they used to maybe be part of that social scene or hang out with those people. And then they're sitting there watching them on social media, feeling like I can't go because I know I'll relapse, things like that. And it's very depressing for people. So this is the thing. We're responsible for what we feed our brains, just like we're responsible for what we feed our bodies. And I really, you know, digital hygiene is something that I really do emphasize for clients that we treat at the program that I own. It's something that I talk to friends about because I feel like it's our obligation. Like this stuff's always out there. There's always a liquor store. There's always, right? There's always Uber Eats. Mm-hmm. There's always shopping. It's all there. You can't avoid all the dangers in the world or the things that can be negative.
Exactly.
It's how do we set up our life so that we don't get sucked in? And some of it is removing apps, right? Some of it is, you know, rewarding yourself only after you've done certain things are you allowed and having to set timers because you know you can get carried away. So these are the things that we can talk to therapists about, coaches, that we can talk to sober supports about. But it's important to address and to kind of figure out where are our blind spots.
I mean, you're hitting it right. You're right on top of everything. And I certainly appreciate your expertise and you sharing it with the listening audience. How can a parent foster emotionally secure environment for their children who may be coping with their parents' recovery journey themselves? Do you have suggestions as to how that parent can foster this milieu for children?
Yes, and I've actually seen it done well. I think part of it is that the parent or parents that have gotten sober and their children witnessed their active addiction, and now they're seeing that they're now entering into sobriety and recovery, that they get their children support that is not just them, that is beyond their words of wisdom, that they get them professional help. And allow them to have a space that they can share what they've been going through, that can also include the parent, depending on the age, as deemed clinically necessary and appropriate, but also that they have that kind of that privacy, right? Mm-hmm. So they need mm-hmm. to balance privacy with right. also family accountability and involvement. That there is acknowledgement around what went on, that it is not a big, dirty, dark secret, that there is acknowledgement that what you saw was real, right? Mm-hmm. And I did have Indeed. This issue. And now I am taking XYZ steps, not, you know, to address it. And the leading by example is huge. So I've noticed that tweens and teens, like older children, that knew that their parent had an addictive issue, often are very supportive of the parent that is taking that time out to go to a self-help meeting or go to the gym or take some downtime. And because they're seeing that that is what's going to allow their parent to lead a healthy lifestyle.
Allow me to interrupt you right now. We need to take a brief break. Just hold your thoughts. Remember what you're talking about. And we'll come back. You're tuned in to 411 Teen.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
Just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, and I am talking with Sarah Allen Benton, Parents in Recovery, Navigating a Sober Family Lifestyle. Sarah, I had to interrupt you. Continue your thoughts, please.
Sure. So there is often this parenting myth that, you know, you can't take any time out for yourself and it's all about your children and they come first. And unfortunately, when parents do too much of that, they also end up with unhealthy and maladaptive coping mm-hmm. skills. If you have so much packed into your day for your children and for your family that the only way you can calm down or the only you time is drinking or using substances, then there's a problem in the way you're living your life. And so when you get sober and your children see that you're actually taking that time, while there may be guilt associated with it initially, there's often positive feedback because maybe you're a little bit calmer or maybe you're more present when you are with your child or children. And they also, it alleviates fears that you may have a relapse because they see that you're taking action. So those things are really important. And also, they're something that is role modeling healthy coping for your children. So that's a win-win.
In your book, you mentioned that women of all ages and backgrounds experience social pressures. What are some of the most common social pressures you see today with women and sobriety?
It's interesting because for a while it was thought that more men had addictive mm-hmm. issues than women.
Exactly.
And that is true. But I think, unfortunately, women have been giving men a run for their money with addictive issues. So that is not the case necessarily. Also, roles have changed and women have, you know, taken on work and being a working parent and doing similar roles to men that maybe in like the 50s or the 60s wasn't as common. And therefore, they also pick up some of those work hard, play hard mentalities. And culturally, it's become more acceptable for women to drink. Quite honestly, I think including stay-at-home parents. There was this mommy wine culture, the sippy cups are for Chardonnay. There's a lot, right? And there's a lot. I talk to parents and they're like, they're birthday parties. Like the kid's 6 years old and there's, you know, there's a bar in the corner. So, you know, there's also societal norms that are unique to different parts of our country, right? When I talk to some people in Boston, it's different than LA. Or when I talk to people that live in Arizona, maybe like when I talk to people that live in different parts of the country or different neighborhoods, or they come from different cultural backgrounds, I found that those norms changed. And so, again, if you live in a heavy drinking area where the parents are throwing them back, it can put pressure on you. And if that's what the moms do, that can, especially, I have to say, especially in the affluent areas, it's amazing how prevalent drinking is with a lot of the mothers. It's wild. I've treated those mothers. I know those mothers, and it's a huge issue, and there's no access. There's no issues with access to buy-in. Right. Right. So.
Especially when you can have it delivered to your door. You don't even have to go
again,
out.
Right. Yeah. It's wild. Mm-hmm. So, and the more that parents co-sign each other's and mothers co-sign each other's drinking, the more acceptable it becomes. So whether you're a working mom or a stay-at-home mom, I think in general, it's just increased in terms of the accepted. It's just very socially acceptable. It can sometimes feel like you're on the outskirts when you're not drinking. And I've had parents talk to me about that. Like even parents that aren't sober, that are just trying to cut back, there are some friends they can't even spend time with because they feel like they're going to get pressured and nagged, and they just feel uncomfortable when they're not drinking around them. Mm-hmm. So I always thought that was interesting too, that, you know, people that are really fixated on how much you're drinking is usually a reflection that they're insecure about their drinking.
Yeah.
Like, why do you care what another person is drinking? Right. Like, just worry about your own drink.
Take care of yourself. Stay in your own lane. Okay.
Exactly.
Oh, well, what about some tips for sober socializing in adult circles? You know, because, you know, you're in these adult circles like you're talking about, and they may involve drinking or smoking a marijuana. How do you have suggestions? How do parents handle that?
I don't know, but I'm hearing more and more about edibles and all kinds of stuff at parties that people are going to. So I want to throw those things out there as well. First of all, there's different, like your children start to get involved in different activities, which can lead you to different groups of parents, right? Like different sports, or if it's dance, or if it's drama, or this or that, you start to socialize with different parents throughout the years that you are parenting. And you can kind of pick up on the vibes and see what's normal for those groups. But honestly, I can say in our case, like my husband and I are both in recovery and we are just very upfront about it. We just tell people that we don't drink, and we will spend time, and we have spent time with different parents at different events that they were drinking. And that's not what I want to do every weekend, but it doesn't mean that I have to completely not spend any time with those parents, especially if it's an event for our kids. I wouldn't go out of my way necessarily to spend time with people that are heavy drinkers in that setting. I think the idea is to also, if you want to connect with people, do other things, right? Grab lunch. You know, if you know that if you go out with, you know, say your friend Jane on a Saturday night, you know, at 8 o'clock, you kind of know what you're going to get. Right. But maybe you have other things in common. Maybe that you want to play tennis together, or maybe you want to go for a walk or a hike, or maybe you want to go to lunch with them and go shopping and do other things. And I think there's many ways. What I notice with women is women connect in many other ways, more ways than men do. I think men really bond over a sport and a drink. Seriously, not to stereotype, but there's a lot of that. In women, in the connections I've had through the years, when I got sober, I didn't lose all my friends because I have 100 other things in common with them, right? Than just drinking. Maybe we drank together when we were younger, but I have other things in common with them. And so it's about rediscovering those other points of connection.
Yeah. Walk the dog or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Do something else.
There's other things. Well, do you have any advice for parents who struggle to balance that whole, what should I say, self-care with the responsibilities of parenting. Because they got to give, I always tell them, you got to give the drummer some, and you are the drummer. And you've got to realize that even though you have multiple responsibilities for parenting. Do you have any advice that you share with parents who struggle in that balance of again, self-care and responsibilities for parenting?
I do. And in fact, one of the chapters in my book is called Self-Care is Not Optional.
Mm-hmm.
So it was interesting when I spoke with parents not in recovery, their perception was that self-care is not optional for parents in recovery, but is somewhat optional for them. So I thought that was interesting. The things that you did for your own and self-care, I like to also call it soul care. I feel like sometimes people think self-care is like getting your nails done or getting a massage. You know, it can be going to church. It can be going to a synagogue. It can be going to, you know, be in nature. It can be spiritual growth. Like, it can be all of these deeper things, right? It can be spending time reading, like whatever floats your boat. And it changes over time as your children, as you go from not being a parent to being a parent, right? Because that's a huge jump. And I do walk through kind of the different phases of being a parent, but like your kids at different ages. But the self-care changes and shifts based on, are you a single parent? Do you have support? Do you have help? Do you have, family that can step in and allow you to, you know, go to a meeting or go, right? Like you have to look at the way your life is set up and also get creative. One of the things that there were different tricks and all kinds of tips that I got from parents, which I appreciated. I absolutely adored all that was shared with me because I'm tired of my own suggestions, but people would say, you know, it's nice to get together with other parents because the kids can play and then we can talk and have adult time. Right. It can become very boring, quite honestly, to sit with your own kid and not have a break and not knowing, you know, what your partner or if you have a partner's like schedule is and all of that. Mm-hmm. Breaking it up and meeting up with people and feeling like, oh, I don't have any, you know, is there, people are afraid to ask. That's the other thing. A lot of people want to help. And sometimes it's just an hour, right? You just want somebody to come over for an hour and just give you a breather. Mm-hmm. Indeed. So it's getting creative and asking for support. I think one of the problems is that people are very, they just are quick to shut down and say, well, this is the way it has to be. And I don't have any time. That's just, you know, what do I do with that? Like if you're talking to somebody and that's their response, that's untrue. Like there's got to be some little thing, and maybe it's when they take a nap or when they go to bed, or maybe it's first thing in the morning. I don't know what it is, but it's certainly everybody has to figure out something that recharges their battery or their battery is going to drain.
Right. Well, we've been talking and talking and talking, but I need to again, in this last section, we don't have that much time left. I'm talking with Sarah Allen Benton. Parents in Recovery, Navigating a Sober Family Lifestyle. Sarah, where can one purchase or access your book and connect more with you? Do you have a website or an app? What can they do? Share with the listening audience how they can continue to receive your words of wisdom.
So my book is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Bloomsbury.com, which is the publisher. Okay. And my website is Benton, B as in boy, HC.com. And my email is on my website, but it's Sarah with an H at BentonBHC.com. I also have Instagram, Parents in Recovery. I honestly don't use that very much, but I have Facebook Parents in Recovery group and LinkedIn. It's my name. And also, I write a Psychology Today blog that is called The High Functioning Alcoholic. And I've done a Parents in Recovery series featured on there. So hopefully that has some resources. My website also has resources and other podcasts I've done and just other things on this topic. So,
okay. How can parents in recovery build, what shall I say, emotional resilience and coping mechanisms for handling stress without turning to past habits. You know, stress, as you know, can really trigger a lot of, you know, regression. So do you have suggestions on how they can build this emotional resilience and coping mechanisms when they are handling stress and not turn to the negativity of past habits?
Well, when you put the substance down, you have to deal with yourself and you have to deal with your emotions and you have to deal with your stress and all of those pieces. So what treatment programs, what self-help programs, mutual help programs, and therapy is all designed to do is to help you to live life without having to self-medicate in those unhealthy ways, right? So it's about learning what does work for you. And usually those coping strategies are not as quick of a hit as the drug mm-hmm. or alcohol. So it's a little bit of a slower play. And that can be hard for people. And that's part of why I think social support is so crucial, is to learn about what is this process that I'm in. Like, I got sober and had no clue what I was signing up for personally. Mm-hmm. I had no idea. And listening to people that had years of recovery speak about their experience and that things I was going through were normal, or questions I had or confusion I was feeling was normal, that really validated but also educated me, because you don't learn about this. I mean, I went and got my master's in counseling and didn't psychology and didn't learn any of this. So mm-hmm. I really think that I would honestly strongly advise everybody do this, not alone, but have social support. If it's in the form of 12-step, She Recovers, Celebrate Recovery. Like, there's so many, Dharma Recovery, Life Ring. I mean, I could go on and on. There's so much social support out there now, and you can learn from people that have walked this path, but also an addiction specialist therapist, right, that mm-hmm. has understanding about this. And also, if you have underlying mental health issues that you're not dealing with, that you are medicating, that is really, it's crucial that you get those treated in one way or another, addressed, or that you learn how to manage those conditions, because it's so easy just to, like you said, go back to that quick fix.
Mm-hmm. What do you say to encourage struggling parents to take pride in their recovery?
Well, first of all, it is a miracle when anyone with an addictive issue takes that first step, asks the question, gets curious about recovery, and takes action. I mean, that's a miracle, because this is a chronic and progressive and fatal disease. There are 23 million Americans that are in recovery. And I do believe this is something we should be proud of. It's hard in the beginning, and I know that because I've been through it personally. I felt a lot of shame when I admitted mm-hmm. that I had alcoholism, or that I was an alcoholic. Like, that was very, I felt that shame, and I understood what others had felt. But I have to say, as the years have gone by, I feel an enormous sense of pride. And that is really something that, when you think about it, like, the recovery portion should be the part that we're proud of, right? And exactly. The action we're taking. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of healing to be done. There are many, you know, regrets people can have, resentments, wreckage of the past that needs to be cleared up. But that all is fixable if you just don't use, right? If you start to chip away at, you know, really finding peace in your life, and mm-hmm. also, you know, making amends, or, you know, making up with, or going through family therapy, or doing whatever it is, like, your recovery becomes a source of pride over time. And it's not immediate gratification. So if you're waiting for that, you know, that's not what recovery is about. It's a long play. It's a long-term investment.
Well, I tell you, I have to steal something from you, and I want to say it. Sobriety is hard. And recovery is a full-time job. Mm. Parenting is hard and more than a full-time job. And I think that you have conveyed that very clearly. Anything closing you want to say in the next 15 seconds?
Well, I just want people to know that they're not alone, and the fact that they're even asking a question is important, or they have a friend that, you know, is maybe curious about this or that you could reach out to for yourself. Like, the first step is just getting honest with one person. Okay. And asking the question to yourself is where you start.
Well, it's time out for this edition of 411 Teen. I've been talking with Sarah Allen Benton, author of Parents in Recovery, Navigating a Sober Family Lifestyle. Thank you so much. Much appreciation to my listening audience for the privilege of your time and ear. This is Dr. Liz Holyfield inviting you to tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. Was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Technical assistance provided by Taylor Cox. If you would like to participate in the 411 Teen or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. You can listen to previous episodes of 411 Teen at wfsu.org.